Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The song made famous by the Bee Gees.
Bee Gees, yeah.
That would have been my first go-to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. None of that's going in.
Oh, right. No. Good.
Good.
So, well, we might need the material.
Well, I've got lots of backup material.
All right, good.
For okay. This. Which, good.
We just watched it now, and yeah. Hal's given me a few of the thoughts on it.
Yeah. I've been watching some other ones at like double speed while I've been waiting for you guys to come on as well.
Okay.
Yeah. We should. I was thinking maybe we should do another few because it reminded me of another few that are actually good episodes.
Ooh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, James, you got the script?
Yeah, I do.
Does everyone remember how to do this?
No.
Okay, well, let's just...
we'll make it up as we go, don't worry.
We'll make it up as we go along.
Britain. An ancient kingdom with legends of violence, cruelty, and torment in its blood. Join your hosts, Ross, John, and James, as they bravely tread where few would dare. Witness their journey into the horrific history of British horror. They are... The General Witchfinders.
So, ladies and gentlemen, goblins and ghouls, welcome back at last to the 29th episode of the General Witchfinders podcast. I'm James in Bournemouth in Southern England.
Are we still not at episode 30?
No, that's the next one.
I'm John Pountney in South Wales, which is in the south of Wales.
I'm Ross in Dorchester in Southern England. And this time we bring you Tales of the Unexpected.
Tonight,
the Memory
we have
Man.
The second of three sessions in the final of the BCE International, the winner to carry away £35,000. Neil Foulds, playing in his first major final, set the early pace this afternoon, in no way overawed by the occasion. One. The battle-hardened Cliff Thorburn was in no mood to let Foulds get away. Thorburn versus Foulds later tonight on ITV.
And you can see that snooker here on Television South in half an hour at 10:30. First, though, it's time for another Tale of the Unexpected.
Do the theme tune, haven't you?
Did it. Well, the link we watched didn't do the theme tune, did it? Which is a bit...
And people will be thanking him for doing not cutting it off in the...
I know, I saw that. Yeah. The high point of any episode of Tales from the Unexpected is the theme tune, isn't it?
And the credits, absolutely.
Yeah, that's weird. It's cut for the end, didn't it?
The version that I watched had it.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, yeah. I just put into YouTube, Tales of the Unexpected Memory Man.
Oh,
and, yeah. Anyway,
doesn't follow my life. Well, James, you're going to tell us all about it.
Yes. So, Tales of the Unexpected was a British television series that aired between 1979 and 1988. Smack bang in our febrile young minds, developing brains, I would say. Each episode told a story, often with a sinister and wryly comic undertones, with an unexpected twist ending. Every episode of Series 1 and a number of episodes in subsequent series were based on short stories by Roald Dahl, collected in the books Tales of the Unexpected, Kiss Kiss, and Someone Like You. Made by Anglia Television for ITV, with interior scenes recorded at their Norwich studios, while location filming mainly occurred across East Anglia. The iconic theme music, as I learned this today and I was amazed, for the series was written by composer Ron Grainer, who is responsible for the Doctor Who theme,
theme
from The Prisoner, and of course, Steptoe and Son.
Yes! Ding, 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 ding,
ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, etc. Right, amazing. So, yeah, just what? So many strings to his bow, that.
What a knack for a tune.
Indeed. Later episodes were set in different locations outside the United Kingdom. I remember seeing one on Jersey. I think I seem to
have we watched one set in America when we was in Glastonbury.
We'll talk about that in a bit. Yeah.
What about with the one with the turtle? Have you seen the one with the turtle?
Was that with a little boy on the back?
Yes.
Well, I had never seen it, but I got the book with the short story in.
It's absolutely mental.
I can't imagine how they depicted that on film. Because
very badly on video, I think.
Yeah.
With it looks like an episode of Duty Free with Keith Barron.
it's very much like a myth, that one, though, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not,
yes. We've got it on DVD somewhere. I'm not sure if it's in our attic somewhere.
Mm.
Carry on, James.
All right, okay. On Saturday night, it's interesting it's Saturday, because for me, it's always a Sunday.
Mm.
To me, it's Sunday night. I've got to go to school tomorrow.
Yeah.
And on ITV, it's Tales of the Unexpected in the South Bank show.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, and then a feeling of sadness. Yeah. Well, but according to this, on Saturday the night, on Saturday night, April 16th, 1983, just after William Shatner's TJ Hooker on ITV, the episode we watched was aired. The Memory Man, directed by Peter Duffel, based on a story by prolific writer Henry Slessor, by whom the term coffee break was coined. Ooh, so he's in advertising first, wasn't he?
Apparently so. That's what Wikipedia told me.
Great. And therefore must be true. And dramatized by Dennis Cannon. The episode featured Colin Blakely, and then Ross has put some of their credits after their names, but he's been quite rude about one of the actors' credits. So I'll just say that it features Colin Blakely, Judy Gleason, Judy Geeson, John
Bickerstaff.
Judy Geeson, John Bickerstaff, John Judd, and the reason why we are doing this episode, the
3 months late.
Great, Bernard Cribbins. I don't think Bernard will mind. No.
What are the pieces of information that we're missing there, James, that you have cut out?
Okay. Well, Colin Blakely was in The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and A Man for All Seasons. Judy Geeson. Am I saying that right? Judy Geeson. was in To Sir With Love, 10 Rillington Place, and apparently a couple of Star Trek Voyager episodes, and still
was
working
she
today.
Really?
She's got a film coming out this year as well.
Good God. She's in Fear in the Night with Peter Cushing, which is something we potentially should watch.
I would like to watch 10 Rillington Place. Is that any good?
It's long and it's unremittingly grim. But at the end, the guy who finds the dead bodies is Patrick from EastEnders.
Oh, okay.
So that's
But then Patrick. It also says John Biggerstaff, and then Ross is just put in brackets, not known for much. Which I thought was a bit harsh on poor Mr. Biggerstaff.
Yes.
So, and then John Judd was in Scum, I'm the Daddy Now, A Bridge Too Far, the huge three and a half hour long disastrous Arnhem Campaign World War II movie. The Prince and the Pauper, and incidentally he's been married to Helen Shapiro apparently since 1988.
Oh wow, it's quite late in life.
No, it's her third husband.
It's a third
lady kid.
But are they still married now?
Apparently so, according to IMDb.
Wow.
So, back to our muse for this episode. Bernard Cribbins became known in the UK for his successful novelty records, The Hole in the Ground, and, of course, Right Said Fred.
Yeah.
And for his appearances in comedy films, including Two Way Stretch and the Carry On series. His other screen roles include the astronaut Vincent Mountjoy in The Mouse on the Moon, Albert Perks in The Railway Children, the barman Felix Forsyth in Alfred Hitchcock's Friendly.
Yeah.
No, Friendly. Friendly. Yes, very good. That was the poorly received sequel. Right. The barman Felix Forsyth in Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy. Phoebe. Sorry, I'm falling apart.
What did you say about
lovely?
Pulls your tits more than he pulls pints. Or something like that.
Yeah. So, the barman Felix Forsyth in Alfred Hitchcock's Frenzy, which was featured previously on a General Witchfinders episode, and the pretentious hotel guest, Mr. Hutchinson, in the classic Fawlty Towers episode, The Hotel Inspectors.
Yes.
On television, he was a regular and prolific reader for the BBC series Jack and Orion, clocking up 114 appearances.
Good God.
Wow. Between 1966 and 1991, he narrated the children's programme The Wombles. Again, so many touchstones for people of our generation and sort of similar age. And he played the title role in CBBC's series Old Jack's Boat. In the 1966 film Daleks Invasion Earth 2150 AD, Cribbins portrayed Tom Campbell, a companion to Doctor Who. 41 years later, he began appearing in the revival series of Doctor Who as Wilfred Mott, the grandfather of regular companion Donna Noble, and a temporary companion to the 10th Doctor.
So he didn't do much in his life, really.
What a career.
And so, something I found out recently, that he auditioned to play the Doctor after John Pertwee.
Did he?
Oh, that would have been good, wouldn't
it? Yeah, and so he would have been the fourth, would have been instead of Tom Baker.
Wow.
And during his interview, he was talking about all the stuff he did in the army and saying like, he could be quite, you know, quite handy. And then the producer was saying, oh, you know, the Doctor doesn't fight anyone. And then he said, when he watched Tom doing it, the first thing he did in Robot was just like beating people up and stuff. So, but he said he never heard back either way, so he just assumed he didn't get it. So it's just quite rude, I thought.
He could still get the part though, couldn't he? I suppose if he never heard back.
I was very moved by the passing of Bernard Cribbins. Even writing that little bit up, I had a little tear to myself.
What about the Queen?
No, wasn't interested in that really.
Good God! I thought we'd do a special Queen episode.
Really? What's she been in?
Is there anything we can think of that anything horror that involves the Queen? We'll have to try and think about that.
My dad was telling me that the reason they seal up the coffins because Queen Elizabeth the First head exploded when she was in a state.
Have you got a joss stick in there, Cleves?
Yeah, because we burnt some fish today, and it smells a bit fishy.
I was just making sure you haven't got a ghostly apparition material.
Ectoplasm sort of coming out of my nostrils.
No. Feel free to cut this bit out, Ross, but my theory was that she was never in that coffin at all, that they just buried her in Windsor.
Yeah.
Definitely. That after she died.
A few people have said this.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that's what Hal thought as well.
I reckon that she just shed her skin and she was in some kind of like, in a giant hyperloop tunnel thing shooting across under the ocean. And that's what got blown up. But it wasn't a gas pipe. It was it was her being sent to her underground lair.
Is that David Icke's?
Exactly, yeah.
Is that David Icke's thoughts?
Yeah. So
he's gone quite quiet recently, hasn't he? Ike.
Hey, David Icke.
I feel bearing. Yeah.
Oh no.
Bearing in mind, you know, I'm really obsessed with people that. Well, I'm sure he probably would. Bearing in mind, you know, I love. It's one of my things that I'm utterly fascinated by in life, which is, you know, people that believe in conspiracy theories. Why do you believe it when there's no evidence for it? Why do people get drawn to this stuff? And then I've read quite a lot of stuff about it, saying that like, in the early noughties, and this is true, I've backed this up from my time working in a bookshop, Ike was huge. Mm. Yeah, he played Wembley Arena for a couple of nights. He did.
David Icke and Ian Brown.
Are you sure that wasn't when he was playing football at Wembley, wasn't he?
No, Ross. So, no, this is all... He was huge. And then it's like QAnon has taken the wind out of his sails. But you'd often see him turning up and, you know, giving quotes in places. But now it's like he's gone.
In a tracksuit.
Oh, there's a brilliant podcast series I've started listening to called Hoax. It's all about, like, another, you know, satanic panic thing going on. But they feature a bit where one of the people who's perpetuating the hoax is talking to someone on David Icke Radio on davidicke.com. And then it's all, David's texting me now. And he said, if you could send us all those documents, he will be happy to publish them and all this kind of stuff.
I'm listening to that podcast as well, Ross. It's very good.
It's good, isn't it?
I can recommend it. Yeah. I enjoyed it a lot. Right. Anyway, so let's crash on with this. So Tales of the Unexpected. So even though it says Saturday night, it's Sunday night for me.
Yeah.
Silhouettes of Naked
Ladies. I thought
it was
on a Wednesday night, so ooh. I was miles out.
I think it bounced around the schedule. So I can tell you what was on that night, because I've got the TV listings for
yeah, come that, on, that, hit us with it,
from that day. So on ITV, when do you want me to start? Yeah. In the morning, or just go all the way through?
No, six
straight to prime time.
From 6 o'clock. But just before, on both, I've got ITV and BBC, it just reminded me of the absolute, I hated the fact that sport was on television from 12:15 until 5:05, you know, the World of Sport on ITV.
If only they would bring it back.
Yeah, so that was on ITV, and then we had a Grandstand on BBC from past 12 until 10:05. Fucking hell.
Yes. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing TV.
On ITV we had, when World of Sport's finally finished, the news, Metal Mickey, followed by The Fall Guy. Followed by the Children's Royal Variety Performance, which I got who was on it that year as well.
So Metal Mickey
featured Royal Variety
of one of the James Randall lookalikes, Mickey Dolenz.
Yes,
Mickey Dolenz was behind Metal Mickey,
the fevered wank dream of Mickey Dolenz. So Stu Francis,
who I could crush a grape.
Checkers,
yeah.
Rod Hobbs,
yeah. Of course.
Roger DeCourcy.
Yeah,
and Nookie Bear.
The bear.
Jimmy Cricket. And I thought Jimmy Cricket was a bit later than 1984.
No, he was
peak around. Cricket.
Yeah.
Martin
Daniels. The only female on here was Bonnie Langford. On that
Brilliant.
Line. Russ Abbott, Kajagoogoo, Modern
this
Romance.
This is a packed, absolutely packed schedule, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, Kim Wilde. Kim Wilde as well. There we go. So let's go back there.
Lovely, yeah. Kim Wilde,
TJ Hooker.
That was
Whit Woo.
That was also before Kajagoogoo decided that people weren't taking them seriously enough, so they needed to relaunch themselves just as Kaja.
Is that what they did?
Yes. Kaja.
Kaja.
They were actually in the top 10 on that week as well. I've got that if you want to be in the top 10 from that date.
Hang on. So what time was TJ Hooker on?
TJ Hooker was on at 9:15. So Tales of the Unexpected one was 9:45.
Yes.
Ooh, it's quite late. I think Tales of the Unexpected for me was this, one of the things which I would sneak down and my mum would be asleep and I'd watch on TV then.
I was allowed to watch it as a treat, I think.
I think
similar for me.
It just makes me think of dressing gowns for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, 100%. Well, there's an episode that features prominently with dressing gowns, which is the main one that I remember.
Well, maybe
we'll come to later. It still haunts me to this day. Yes.
And I can remember that one with Joan Collins and some like weird sculptures outside, and at the end she gets beheaded or something. It was weird. I remember thinking it was weird when I was a kid, and I've never revisited it.
They just need to bring this kind of stuff back, because it's like it was like, we'll bring in a star and then we'll make them look weird and weird things will happen to them, and that's the end, isn't it really? So it's Holly Willoughby comes in now, and maybe there's a wax figure of her, and then at the end she's melted and the real Holly Willoughby is melted as well.
But
live on TV with Philip Schofield. Yeah. And it would just be 30 minutes to build up to that ending, won't it, really?
I'm just waiting for Philip Schofield.
Ross.
I'm not because I want him to.
Don't include this.
No, all I'm saying is that he's probably taking this so badly, you know, this sudden turn of the affections.
Public enemy number one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's done nothing. It's just, oh man. It's Right, even my barber was having a go at him the other day.
Who was your barber?
Yeah. Just saying how disgusting he thought it was. And I was like, I don't think it actually happened. This is, again, a massive conspiracy theory.
Yeah. David Icke. Yeah.
They need to freshen up the act on this morning, and they've had to try and find a way to get them off.
Straight the golden handcuffs. We're talking about an episode where Philip Schofield...
Yeah.
It's there to be written, isn't it?
Exactly.
How would he do it? Would he jump through one of the LED screens in the background, which is showing a slow-mo version of the River Thames forever? Now they're, even though they're now in Television Centre.
Well, the final shot would be him laying in state and all the public filing past him, regretful that what they drove him to.
And then do you know what would happen? There would be like a hologram of the Queen there looking at his coffin, and she wouldn't bow to his coffin.
Yeah.
And she's got Gordon the Gopher on her. she just makes him do that laugh.
They would put a little black armband on him, wouldn't they?
Zoom.
Yeah. Just Wilson the Butler there as well.
That was Paul Burrell, wasn't it?
Yeah. Was there a broom? Did a broom come in at one point?
That was a janitor, wasn't it? I can't remember.
I thought there was just a broom which would come in and out, like like a sweeping
brush. No expense spared, was there?
So anyway, this episode, I found this quite a slippery beast, to be honest. Mm. I couldn't tell what was happening until about the last 5 minutes. And then then when it finished, hell said if they missed off the ending. So we were just like, what's happening? So it kind of, it opens with him putting up some adverts in a shop or something.
Yeah. Well, I can remember my mum putting adverts in a shop window, but I can't remember what for. And that sounds really dodgy, doesn't it?
I was about to say, it was the early 80s internet, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's how you got stuff out there.
Yeah. And he did imply that it would cost extra if you were a prostitute to put the cards up in the window, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who said that?
The guy. He said, how much? It just depends what you're advertising. He said, I'm not a model.
Oh, I don't know if I caught that bit. I once bought a full Capri from an advert in Tesco's.
Oh, yeah.
In big Tesco's in Cabalva, bought a Capri for £220.
I think.
With a very badly slipping clutch.
I think I wanted to put one in the window asking for a pen pal, but the fact it was in my in the shop of my own news agent, so we're going to be very far away.
Yeah, so this man is basically, he's just taking off Rigsby for me. He's just playing Leonard Rossiter.
Mm.
Mm.
He's playing Leonard Rossiter, playing Rigsby.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
And I thought it was going to be a drama about quizzing.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Like Barry from EastEnders in real life loves quizzing, doesn't he? So I thought it might be something like a drama about...
What was the name of the guy who cheated on the...
Major Charles Ingram.
Yeah,
the guy that coughed in the background. Mm. Yeah, so I thought maybe it's going to be a drama about quizzing and memory, but very quickly it changes tack.
Well,
and then this man goes to his weird little church.
Yeah, so he set up a whole school
room.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
With
so weird.
Yeah.
And then he's got like a secretary or a girlfriend.
Yeah.
Can't really tell which. And that's TV's Judy Geeson. Mm. Who it was a very big pinup in the 70s. I don't know, by this point, she was probably still very famous, but I don't know if she was still quite as prolific as she was in the 70s, because she did absolutely loads in the 70s. But again, like their relationship, can you tell what it's meant to be?
No, because he looks way too old for her.
And my notes was he's punching way above his weight. way above his weight.
Like, he's like Muhammad Ali. or like...
Fighting Rod Cole.
Yeah. Or maybe
boxer.
Norman Wisdom knocking out Muhammad Ali with his hands tied behind his back. It's like, what? It just doesn't make any sense.
And it looks like he's been in this building for a very long time.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes.
So was it a fact that his
it looked like a church.
His memory... training school used to be successful.
Yeah, it's fallen on hard times. Maybe.
Hard times. Yeah. Yeah.
Or was it a case of like he's never had any people working there?
No. So what was she doing? Well, she was one of his pupils.
Yes. So
who
yes.
has now come to work for him?
But there was also a romantic undercurrent.
Question mark.
Because, like, she says, oh, well, I'm going to go and leave. You know that guy who we met in the Grand Hotel in Brighton? He's very rich. And
yes.
It does sound like he's going to be making a lot of money because he runs an oil rig off of the North Sea,
yeah.
just off of Aberdeen. And then he's like, oh, no, don't leave me, don't leave me.
Yeah.
And she says, no. Well, like, you know, I'm sorry. And she's like, well, it was never really this, meaning them two, was never really working, was it? Which I thought, oh, man, you know, put the knife in.
Yeah, and then he says, together later on in the episode.
Well, yeah, because it's like she walks out, this is her leaving.
Yeah.
And then again, sees her two other times and she leaves again.
She leaves in installments.
Yes.
She leaves on three separate occasions. But yeah, he then says to her, she's leaving. Wait, if I find some oil out in the yards, she went, oh, I'll come back then.
Yeah.
So thus I've put, confirming it is all about money.
Yeah.
Thatcher's written in it.
Yeah.
Peak Thatcherism. Yeah. She, and when she's got bad news to tell him, she says, I've bought us a bottle of scotch, a whole bottle of scotch. Like, how bad is the news?
People's alcohol intake was much higher in the early
80s. Right?
Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting you say this, Ross, because the other day when I was driving home from work, Radio 4 was...
You'd had three pints, James, already.
I had, yeah.
He was towing his Nan's booze trolley behind him.
Oh, Nan's booze trolley, lovely. The hostess trolley. Right. So they were... And on the show on Radio 4, they were talking about how public attitudes had changed over the years. And they cited, first of all, people picking up dog shit now, and they were just saying, you know, that's something that just simply didn't happen, whereas now that's normalized
myself.
And also they said, you know, kind of like smoking, how, you know, that's the views on that have changed. And they were saying that, you know, this idea that public values are set in place absolutely aren't, you know, it's not the case at all. Things do change. And they highlighted and said, I thought, oh yeah, that is true, that they said, oh, if you look back at the culture of like the 1970s and 1980s, drinking in the day was far more de rigueur.
Everyone would go to the
pub at lunchtime. Right? And it's true. And they just said, this just doesn't happen anymore. And I thought, oh, that's...
We used to
do it in college.
Yeah.
Like people... So I'm talking about 1995, foundation course. Mm. Everyone would go to the pub.
Yep.
And most of the boys would have a pint. I wouldn't have a pint because I've never drunk a pint. But I can remember some of the boys having like two pints at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon
all my
when
best
they going back to college.
All my best painting was done after a couple of pints.
Now that's bizarre, isn't it? So that must have been, I would have been, so I wasn't even 20 at that point.
Mm. Yeah.
So I don't think anyone...
And everyone was smoking in the pub then as well.
Yeah. I would have a basket of chips.
We'd be smoking at college, wouldn't we?
Yeah,
smoking in the college building.
Yeah, definitely. In Tommy's bar.
Yeah.
Oh, classic.
But we was told. When Beck's great uncle died, we had to go and sort of clear out his house, and we had to get the keys from some of his friends. And they were. We turned up at probably about 11 o'clock. You could tell they was pissed already. These old people, and they just would not have it that Beck wouldn't. We wouldn't all have a drink while we was there with them. And Beck was going, drive yourself. Okay, we'll just do a small one. And they were getting so insistent that we must have alcohol before they left.
Yeah,
I think it is so much more drinking was going on back then.
Yes. So anyway,
evidence.
We've got past the first 5 minutes of this episode so far. So then, all I've got
Cribbins.
Cribbins comes in. So I've had the debate with myself. Is she secretary? Is she his partner? Like, what's going on? And then the point of the episode comes in, which is Bernard Cribbins, and he's basically forgotten something, which he wants to remember, which doesn't seem to tally up with the guy.
No, because he's
offering.
He teaches people how to remember.
To improve
not
to
their memory. Not
to recall.
Yeah, it's not about delving into someone's memories, is it? It's more to do with how to make your memory better. So then it's explained that Cribbins has basically put something in
of great
locker.
Value.
So does he say at that point what it is?
He says it's very important.
Yes.
And it's absolutely urgent that I get yes. this thing back.
So he's put it in a locker in a station, and then he's forgotten the key code because it's made in Japan.
Yeah.
In inverted commas.
Which goes back to our episode on the Stone Tape, where they were obviously... There was a lot of anxiety about Japanese technology in this
latent racism and worries about Japanese taking over.
There was a bit when to prove that he's got an excellent memory, he recalled the some acts which were on a variety act, and there was a very racist description of.
You'll be pleased to know, Ross. I made a note of that.
Yeah,
because I just put that cancelled. Yeah, but they were cool.
Yeah.
The Kinky Doo Chinese acrobats and the Great Fedora.
Is that like just a giant fedora hat?
But I hope so. I was about to say, I just can imagine John Peel going, and that was the Kinky Doo Chinese acrobats and the Great Fedora. And their EP is coming out on Island Records. Now here's the fall. Bingo Masters Breakouts, etc.
I think you should be known as the Great Fedora from now on, James.
Yes, great. I'm down with that. But I'm claiming it.
You'd never wear a hat. He never wears a hat.
Yeah, that's right. Fedora. Why? Why is he called the Great Fedora? That's for me to know. Yeah, sorry. So yes, the mise en scène of this whole thing is something in a railway locker. Bernard Crimmins establishes that it's a new kind of technological lock that.
Masterpiece.
You put it, yes. That, you know, once you put it in, did they say first of all it gives you like a randomized set of numbers?
No, you have
yes,
to.
Yes, on a,
or like you, a, or you,
you type them or in, and you get it, print it out for you to see what you
yes, get. Yes, you get a paper printout. Yeah, right, yeah.
But and then in the interim, he has screwed up, destroyed, and lost the number code. He can't remember the number code, and he is now asking our protagonist, the Nemanist,
something just occurred to me. Called. Right?
Yeah. Yes.
So he knows he's seen this guy somewhere before, because the Nemanist is an excellent memory man. He can remember seeing him in the newspaper, and he knows that he's a famous safecracker.
Mm. Well, it dawns on him later on. Then.
Yeah.
He starts,
but if he's a famous safecracker, why doesn't Cribbins just break...
it's exactly what I've written.
Open up the thing to get it out.
Yeah. But he does it with dynamite.
Oh, yeah, that was
He's a safecracker who does it with dynamite, but that's what we... That's the ending where you're just like, what? What?
So, yes. He
draws a moustache on a newspaper picture of him, doesn't he?
Which is nuts, because it's as if that suddenly makes Bernard Cribbins look any way different.
Is he doing that in his memory? Or in his mind? Because
No.
I couldn't work that out either.
Because it's his memory of reading it in the paper, and then does he go back drawing behind the paper and draw it, or is this something you're seeing inside his brain?
Well, possibly.
Yes, that's what I questioned. With a bad video effect, wasn't it?
It's just like Lois Lane drawing the glasses on Superman and Superman 2 in the paper, and then
similar vibe. So he agrees to sort of take Cribbins on board with he draws the fair conclusion that whatever Cribbins has stowed away must be loot from his last safe.
Not drugs.
It's not drugs. And I put down Bernard Cribbins' angry voice is one of the best angry voices in the world.
Yeah.
When he's angry, he sounds amazing.
So loved and so soft.
Nice.
You do feel like you wouldn't cross him, would you?
Wouldn't go across him.
No. So,
pulling your tits more than you've been pulling pints. Don't put this in. Don't put that in. We'll have Corbynites writing to us.
Our memory man starts to give him a very kind of pared-down version of his memory course, in which he tells you some very basics about Freud and the unconscious and stuff like that.
And
it comes down to association, assimilation, and correlation. Mm. And he's like, just hurry up and tell me how to remember things. And then that doesn't work. And he suggests, maybe I can hypnotize you. Because often the case,
this bit may
hypnotize a person. I can actually, access the unconscious more readily, and many things which we believe have been forgotten by our, you know, in our sort of front brain can be retrieved from the cortex. So yeah, they decided they're going to do that. And once again, we then get another scene where he speaks to
Judy Geeson.
Yeah. Mary. She's got that. So he sees Mary again, and he's like, "Don't leave yet. I'm about to make a lot of money."
Yes.
And she's just really not having it. She's like, "Oh no. Well, I'm still going to go. I'm still going to."
This is when he's reading a big orange book, which is just called Hypnosis.
Yeah.
which looks like it's drawn with Letraset on the cover of it. Doesn't it?
It probably was. By the
grass. Yeah. It really made me laugh out loud. That did.
Implies that he didn't even know how to hypnotize this guy. No. That's why he sent him away. He thought, I can learn this overnight. And then Cribbins just succumbs to the hypnosis very, very quickly, doesn't he?
Within 10 seconds, he's hypnotized.
Yeah.
Charlie Krabs, as we find out that he's called at this point.
Yeah. Mm.
He's the that's his robbery name. I don't know if that's some kind of robbery pseudonym or if he was christened Charlie Krabs. It's quite an unusual surname, isn't it?
Not in Portland, near where I lived. Apparently, most people really? On Portland are called Crab.
Oh, is that? Oh, really?
And if you go and look at the war memorial there, it's just it's got lots of crabs up there.
It's very Wicker Man, Ross. Yeah. That's all very Wicker. Yeah.
That sounds like a good E.F. Benson ghost story where they're all descended from crabs that come out of the sea once a year or something.
Or with a certain tide, they all scuttle sideways.
Into
the foam.
That's excellent.
Write that, please, someone.
So, where have we got to now?
he's now about to... he now hypnotises very quickly Bernard Cribbins, who then gives him the number, which I wrote down, which is 154-6237. That's the number. It's locker number 154, and the code was 6237.
That's not Victor Meldrum's phone number.
That's 4291.
Door 4291. Yep. Amazing. And then that thing where he picks up the phone and he's expecting to be the phone and it's a puppy.
Yeah.
That one time.
Oh! Adduction.
Is it? Well remembered. And having ascertained that the number of the lock, our memory guy is absolutely thrilled. He brings Cribbins back out of the trance and says, sorry, mate. Ha ha. Couldn't get anything. But anyway, I've got to go now. Have your money back. Ha ha, bye. And then sprints off. Straight away, you think, I'm just going to follow him. He probably has got something. That seemed weird.
You'd also question why he hasn't ushered you out of his church place and locked the door.
Yeah.
He's just left you stood there in the street, left the building open. Help yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then comes back and is worried that he's still inside. Well, don't go back there then.
Why would he still be there? Yeah, so he goes to the station, goes to the locker.
There's a little bit of business where
he forgets the number.
Yes, and then he hears the platform number, which reminds him.
So he puts 7 at the end.
Gets the bag out, goes back to his weird church classroom.
Woman's on the sea.
Yeah. Opens the bag. Finds the money in there.
Mm. Yeah.
And then finds a shoebox full of wires, it looked like to me.
Yeah.
So I was just like, okay, what's that?
And dynamite.
Wait for it. No, you. I don't think you see the dynamite to start off.
Well, I couldn't see dynamite or anything. So I was just what's that box full of wires?
I've just written down old tenors klaxon. It's just nice to see a load of old tenors, massive tenors, £10 notes. That they had.
But this is intercut with his girlfriend talking, saying, Mary. I don't want to leave him after all. I'm too attached to him.
Too attached to him. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. He needed to have gone through all of this anyway.
Yeah.
Because she was never going to leave.
Yeah.
And then she rings him to tell him that she's not leaving. And he...
Yeah.
Makes him jump.
Yeah. So he drops the box of shoebox full of wires, and then the church blows up.
Yeah. Havoc blew the place up, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, okay. That's quite a downer.
Yeah. and then the coda
is them sort of sifting through the rubble, the police and Mary. And he goes, ah, yes. So I suppose, you know, it must have been, he must have gone and got Bernard Cribbins' stuff. However, he forgot what he might have remembered his name, but he forgot what he was known as. Gunpowder Charlie. The end. Charlie.
Yeah, so bit of a damp squib, that one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
If it was a damp squib, it would have gone off.
So.
And you don't see Cribbins again. He's disappeared by that point.
No, he's already cashing the check, isn't he?
Yeah. So it's a very oddly written piece of television drama, wasn't it? It didn't feature Roald Dahl at the start in a dressing gown sat by a fireside.
Yeah, but I think it's because Roald Dahl only did the first couple of seasons and then the rest of it was other people.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the guy who the original story for this one, this guy wrote loads of stuff under loads of different pseudonyms, but he got picked up by Alfred Hitchcock, and he wrote a loads of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents. But it was adapted for British television by a British guy. But
I see. I was listening to something on BBC Sounds the other day. It was a role.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Roald Dahl's short story, and it was about a woman who's cooking dinner for a husband. He comes home, gives her bad news. She murders him using a frozen leg of lamb.
Mm-hmm.
And then cooks the lamb and feeds it to the police.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I'm sure I've read this story before. And then I realised it was an episode of Tales of the Unexpected I'd seen.
Yeah, I think I've seen that one. Yeah.
Which is, it's quite a good, because obviously then she destroys the evidence of the murder weapon. But I was like, God, I'm sure I know what's happening in this story. I'm sure I've heard this before. Then I realised it was a Tales of the Unexpected.
Yeah, I just watched one tonight, which was about a woman who was eavesdropping another conversation in a restaurant, and then she was convinced that this woman was having an affair with her husband, and just kept becoming obsessed with it and kept going back every lunchtime and listening more and more. And then she noticed that this woman was wearing a watch, which was the same as the one she'd lost, and she was convinced her husband gave it to her. So on the way back, she pushes her out in front of a lorry, and the woman gets run over.
Oh, gosh.
And then her husband rings her up at home to say, oh, we're going to Munich on a work trip. Could you pack my bag? And when she gets her suitcase down, her watch falls out of the suitcase because it was in there. So it was all in her mind.
How unexpected.
That was a good one.
Silly cow. Jealous Stupid Women, that one is called, isn't it?
one of the ones I remember from the books, and I don't know, they must have filmed this one, is that there's a guy on a cruise and he's like an absolute degenerate gambler and says and makes a bet, and he's like losing all his money while he's on this cruise. And he says to this guy, look, I've really got to win my money back. So like an all or nothing bet. I bet you anything, this ship won't get in dock at Singapore or what have you, and it will be late. The ship won't dock at the correct time. And the guy says, "Yeah, all right, I'll take the bet." And then what he does is he thinks that every day when he's been walking around the ship, there's been an old lady who sat in one position, who he always says good morning to, and he's like, "Right, what I'll do is I'll throw myself overboard." The old lady will see me. She'll call for help. They'll have to stop the ship to come and get me. And then I win the bet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he kind of like, ooh,
launches himself overboard, and it kind of it finishes with the old lady getting her white stick out, and she's blind.
But so the thing is, with all of these stories, we tell that in like three or four sentences in a minute, and then
and you're like, oh, that's clever.
Yeah, and then they drag it out over 29 minutes with probably an advert break in the middle as well.
Yeah, yeah.
The one I very, very clearly remember is when I was staying over my father's house. So this would have been in 1985.
Mm-hmm.
It was on repeated recently on Sky Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching the episode and I was like, this is really weird, but this, like, it's almost like deja vu because I've never seen it since.
Mm.
And it's a episode where a landlady is murdering and stuffing the young men that come and stay in her bread and breakfast.
Yes.
And all I remember is the final scene, which is a guy is like anesthetized and he's ushered into this room. And then you see his new kind of housemates, and she's like, oh, meet your new friends kind of thing. And it's like two blokes in bed, I think, two like single beds in like an attic room. And they're obviously stuffed.
Mm.
And oh my God, that absolutely scared the living shit out of me when I was seven.
Yeah.
And then I saw it again, like very recently. And I was just like, whoa, this is really dark. And I haven't seen it for like, well, nearly 40 years.
Yeah.
And it was just, wow, like, they don't seem to put anything like this on television anymore at all.
Again, whenever we say this, we always then go, oh, Inside Number 9 does it. But then, that's it.
But that's about it, isn't it? Like,
But they just announced that Series 9 is going to be their last series. So
oh, really?
They're making Series 8 now. So the one after that is going to be their last series.
It must be really hard to come up with new material.
Yeah.
Because it's just been those two for like 9 seasons, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Bloody hell.
So the one me and James watched when we was in Glastonbury was about, it was an American one where a rich guy was...
David Cassidy, no less.
Yeah, David Cassidy. He was killed by David Cassidy, but David Cassidy was a twin.
Twin.
And they did lots of...
Split screen shots. And he was like,
one of
I admit
him,
that I did it.
But you can't prove which one of us it was.
Yeah, they were really smug about it.
I can't remember
David Cassidy.
Did it.
So like, was it something to do with a kiss?
Yeah, it was at the end. A kiss, wasn't it?
Something to do with a kiss. I can't remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's thrilling for the listener.
But me and James, we'd all packed and we split.
So when was this? Had I met you at this point, or was this after I'd met you?
We saw on our way home, but we'd all got dressed, all had our bags, and we stood like holding our bags in the hotel room just to wait to see what the twist was. So I think we stood there for about 10 minutes to work out how are they going to get out of this one.
So this is on Sky Arts as well.
It was,
yes. It's weird scheduling, isn't it? Like, middle of the day, there's like two episodes, isn't there?
Yeah, it's considering like, this was like, seen as way too scary and it must be on really late at night, you know?
Yeah.
And now it's just on in the day for anyone to watch.
Yes. Yeah. But I was watching Talking Pictures about 3 years ago, 4 years ago now, before lockdown. And there was a film on at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And, it was a cowboy film with Ursula Andress.
Mm.
Wow.
And then about halfway through, she's like topless in the water.
Yikes.
I was like, this is on it. What on earth is going on?
John is scrambling for the VHS tape to try and record it. Where's my booby tape, hair? Where's my booby tape?
I can't put this on. She was in work pre-lockdown. Yeah, so it's just... I think that these channels, they put stuff on and they're just like, no one's going to bloody watch it. It doesn't matter what we put on.
Exactly, yeah.
Mm.
And our demographic are over 60s. They can handle it. It's just,
Or they've seen worse. A few of them.
Yeah.
Might tip them over the edge.
But
to see Ursula Andress naked.
So what did we think of this episode?
It's pretty derisory for me.
Yeah.
But it was good to see Bernard doing something a little bit different. Although the last two things we've watched, he'd been a similar kind of.
Yeah. I'd say, I can't remember now, but relative to my previous scores, this is probably like a 1 out of 5 or something, isn't it?
That's the same as what we all gave Scar of Dracula, that was.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's a 1.
Yeah, I'd say this is a 2 for me then, because Scar of Dracula is
crap.
Charmless.
Yeah.
And that's the best I can say about it.
Okay. So. It's a 1 for me. No, I'm going to give it a 2.
Yeah. But it was nice to watch something that was only half an hour long. Yeah. I was really satisfied with that.
I think that is a good thing, because sometimes 90 minutes is like... You're talking about ideas being spread over 30 minutes here. Like sometimes a Hammer film, like ideas spread over 90 minutes, you're just like, fucking advice.
yeah, come on. Well,
If this was Hammer, they would have shown that whole bike ride that guy did.
Yeah.
It was good to watch the Tales Unexpected. I think I will watch more of them. But.
I think we should, I think we should definitely do more of them. And I think we should certainly do maybe a randomized selection of the episodes of the Hammer House of Horror.
Yeah. Hammer House of Horror. TV series. And that other one you got us to watch where it was a bit like Eleanor Rigby in the titles. So I watched one of those. That was quite good.
Oh, yeah. There's not many episodes of that.
What was it called?
I can't remember. Something of Fear, Tales of Fear. And that was on Talking Pictures as well.
Yeah.
I have just bought the DVD box set of The Rivals of Sherlock Holmes after seeing... that on Talking Pictures.
One of the people in this was in that, because I saw that in
there. Oh, really? Yeah, it's not horror, obviously, so there's no point in us watching this, but it's TV plays based on detective fiction written at the same time as Conan Doyle's writing Sherlock Holmes.
That's a good idea.
So it's a really good idea. So one of them is the guy that, when you said about Private Lives of Sherlock Holmes, the guy who plays Sherlock Holmes in that, whose name I can't remember, plays another blind detective. Mm-hmm. And that's a really good episode. That's really fun because he's got a kind of Holmesian sense of forensic analysis, but he's blind.
Mm-hmm.
So that episode is really good. But it's like a Thames television series from like 1971 or 72 or something. But it's really well done. The sets are great. And one of them is... what's his name now? The baddie from Porridge. Peter Vaughan.
Yeah.
One of them's Peter Vaughan as well. So that's
Grouty. Good. Is that his name?
Is that what he's called?
Yeah, I think it's called Grouty.
Grouty.
Yeah. Yeah. And also there was Dead of Night was a TV series as well, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
We can watch some episodes of that. That's good. There's one where they're having a weird party. It's just a lot of... A lot of these 70s things you watch, they're like, it's people having weird dinner parties and having a nervous breakdown in the course of...
Yeah.
And you think, a lot of people are dinner parties.
Yeah, and they all get fed a human at the end or something.
Are you going to do your intro?
Okay. I can't remember the end. So...
Now it's time for something horrific.
Something we've watched, done, read.
This week.
This week, yeah. To say, we're probably going to be doing these episodes monthly from now on, just to let you know. But so this month, John, what have you done horrifically?
It wasn't horrific, but it was sci-fi. But I think it says on Twitter that we're allowed to do some sci-fi.
Yes,
So while I've been painting recently, I've been listening to a sci-fi drama on BBC Sounds, which is called The Slide, which was written by TV's Victor Pemberton, who wrote a Patrick Troughton story for Doctor Who, which is called Fury from the Deep.
Mm.
And The Slide is...
He didn't write Spearhead from Space, did he?
He didn't write Spearhead from Space, no. Okay. I can't remember who did. I think that was Terence Dix.
Oh, okay.
But it is the only Doctor Who story that was ever shot entirely on 16mm.
Oh, yes. Interesting.
That's the reason why that they've been able to do such a good Blu-ray on.
Yeah, that'd be good. We should do that sometime.
We should do that one sometime. But yeah, so it's called The Slide. It's quite Nigel Neal.
I think I've heard it. I think. What's it about?
I'd say that it doesn't need to be seven episodes long, but it is, if you want atmospheric 1960s.
It's about an earthquake.
It's about a kind of sentient mud that comes out of the ground and tries to take over a town somewhere in Dorset or somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Ooh,
maybe you live by there now. Yeah. But it's got Morris Denham in. It's got Roger Delgado, who's he's the master from Doctor Who.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's
he's in Spirit from Space.
He isn't.
Uh-huh.
He's in Terror of the Autons.
That's the Autons when he's with. Oh, yeah, sorry.
That's his first story. That's the Master's first story. So it's very, very, very worth listening to. It's got good sound effects from Radiophonic Workshop. It's just got loads of atmosphere, and I really enjoyed it while I was painting away. It's good to pass a few hours, and I would give it a solid 8 out of 10, really.
There we go.
Or 3 out of 5.
So
3.5 out of 5.
So did much better in this episode. James.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Have you got anything for us?
Yes. Kirsty and I went to see the play 222.
I'm very jealous.
The what?
Right. Ones? Okay. There has been
what
a play.
What did you go and see, James?
A play called 222.
Oh, yes. Is this what Lily Allen was in before?
Yes. 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 This is a trend that started since like the late 90s. Remember the play Art?
Yes.
Yes.
Where it was, in short, a person tries to sell an empty frame, and the whole play is about how sort of like the foot with one philosophical friend is like, well, you know, well, what is art? The other one's on the make, and the other one's sort of caught in the middle. And the whole idea behind Art was that it was just a play that could run and run, and you just kept on dropping stars into it,
yes,
thus keeping the run going. And this is something that it seems like they've done with 222, as John correctly says. It's, you know, started off with Lily Allen in it, although
and
I'm really thinking.
Planning.
Yeah, and but I'm now starting to think they're getting towards the bottom of the barrel, with all due respect, because we had Matt Willis from Busted.
Oh, wow.
Right. Gary
Wilmot and Bella Emberg.
Jimmy Cricket.
But yes, it's a ghost thing, though, isn't it? It's written by the guy who did Uncanny.
Yes. Now, what I would say is that, number one, first of all, it's being shown in the theatre at Piccadilly Circus, which I'd never been down into, but you go down into it. It's a subterranean theatre. And what I would say is, you know, Ross and I were lucky enough, we went and saw Ghost Stories when Ghost Stories came out.
Yeah.
And for me, that is still the high watermark for something being spooky. And Kirsty and I were talking about this afterwards, and I said, if you're going to do something spooky in a theatre, you've got to use the medium properly. You've got to use the fact that you're seeing something on stage, because really what this felt like was something that could have just easily been done on TV. There was nothing extra spooky about it being in the theater, and it could have been really, really easily. And it's a one set play ultimately. Mm. And as I was watching it, I did think Ross would be spending this whole time trying to guess the end.
Yeah.
And they do say at the end, do not, don't reveal. And I wouldn't do that.
Cool.
But then, but what I do have to say is that the main thing I want to report back in is the fact that behind us, act one, and it's all underway and characters talking about what's going on and all this, there's things going on in the house. And it's like, but isn't that what you want me to say? And yes, you've always denied ghosts and things like that. And then from behind me,
amazing.
And I turn around, and there was a guy who had to be in his late 50s, just absolutely fucking out. He was watching it on his own. He was asleep.
Wow.
He was on his own and absolutely fast asleep. And there were people next to him who weren't with him, but they were just sort of sat looking straight ahead. And I turned around and looked at them. And I looked at the lady who was sat next to me, who looked utterly mortified.
Yeah.
And so that, once a teacher, always a teacher. So I leant back, I turned around, and I sort of grabbed him by the knee, and I went, "Sir, "You are snoring quite loudly." So he went, "Whoa, whoa." And because of the size of the theatre, I don't know how far that travelled. Because it's not a big theatre, so I don't know if my admonishing this guy for snoring. But yeah, he...
amazing.
He vanished for Act 2. He did not return.
Did he?
Yeah, he was only there for Act 1.
Good Lord.
Maybe he was a ghost.
Maybe.
Sleeping.
Maybe he's the one in the Graham Greene story who's done the murder.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, she told me about that. Yeah,
that's a great story.
I think I read it.
So who was in it, James? Gary
Will. Matt Willis from Busted.
Yeah.
And then a couple of other people.
Paul Mackey was in it once, I think.
Yeah, but it was a couple of people that I didn't recognise. Should have been somebody from... It was like someone from Love Island was supposed to be in it. And it was one of those, tonight her role will be being played, but, you know, it's the understudy was in.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The elderly couple that was sat next to Kirsty were furious that she wasn't in it. Yeah. Kirsty heard them complaining to us, going, "Why was this not announced before Curtin came up?" It's like, well, what can you do about it? You paid the money for tonight. The show's about to start. But anyway, it was only really kind of Matt Willis from Busted who was anyone of...
I would have gone to see Lily Allen because she's one of my top pop pinups. But I don't know. How long is the play? This is 2 acts.
It was 2 hours. Started at 7:30, finished at 9:30 with a 25-minute interval. Yeah.
Well, my thing, I started reading Anno Dracula.
Ooh.
Has anyone read this?
No. Is that Kim Newman?
Kim Newman, yeah.
Looks like a big book, Cleves.
It's the first of a series of books. So it's the blurb is, it's 1888, Queen Victoria has remarried, taken her new consort, I can't say that word, Welkian prince, infamously known as Count Dracula. His polluted bloodline spread through London as citizens increasingly choose to become vampires. In the grim backstreets of Whitechapel, a killer known as Silverknife has cut down vampire girls. The eternal young vampire, Genevieve... Oh, I can't read these words.
Genevieve.
Yeah, Genevieve, something. So basically, I can't read out loud.
But are you reading the book, please? Or do you just skip words in the book?
Well, I look at the names as such shapes, so I know who they are. And also... really helpfully, he's got the names of all the characters on the front and explains who they are.
Yeah,
so,
I did.
Nice.
I did wonder.
So when I'm going,
was.
Who's that old? He's a spy. All right. So, it hasn't got much of a story to it yet.
it looks like a bloody long story for the thickness of the book.
And I think it's a lot of this person being clever to put in like loads of Victorian, so like Dr. Jekyll's in it, Sherlock Holmes is in it. Yeah, basically any famous Victorian person is in it in some way. And I think there's a lot of references which are going over my head.
So it's like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah, but it's basically there's loads of vampires in London. And it's all about like there's vampires in the Houses of Parliament, so they have to have it at night and all that kind of stuff.
Wow, that's no surprise.
And Dr. Stewart is basically Jack the Ripper.
Sayward? I thought it was Dr. Sayward.
I thought it was Seward. Oh, yeah, Sayward.
Oh, I've always said Sayward.
Anyway, he's Jack the Ripper. He's going around killing, because he's killing vampires. But in the manner of, he's using a silver, scalpel in order to cut their hearts out.
Yeah.
So everyone's trying to find out who it is and trying to stop him at the moment. But it's okay. It's all right. But the one other thing I got is, wait there, I'm going to go and get it. Alexa, turn on the loft.
What's he say?
He's talking to Alexa, isn't he?
To turn on the loft.
Loft.
What the fuck does that mean?
Oh, God, I knew that. I thought he was going to be like 3 seconds, not 7 seconds.
What is he doing?
I can't go to work in the morning.
I know. There he is. Look.
I can't find that. I'll do that next time. basically, it's the I got the soundtrack to the spin-off podcast we're doing. We did Possum recently, which is
yes,
the music is by the Radiophonic Workshop, and I've got it on 12-inch.
The real Radiophonic Workshop. Yeah, someone using the name.
The real Radiophonic Workshop.
Who is it though? Is it Marquez?
Yeah, I think so. I'll go and find it. One second.
Didn't have to go and find it, but there we are.
But it is good. I will say that you know.
Is it a British film then?
Yes, it is. It's the guy who is Garth Marenghi.
Right.
So it's very weird, and he says, you know, it's influenced by German expressionism. It goes on a fair old. You know, it's as we were just talking about tonight. It could have been done in 45 minutes.
Yeah,
really effectively done in 45.
Oh, because it's called Possum. I thought it was Australian.
No.
Hello, Possums.
Marquez.
Yeah,
he's on flute, piano, lampshades, samples, and effects. Peter Howell.
Oh, yes.
Paddy Kingsland.
Yes.
Roger Lim.
Yes.
Yeah. Kieran Pepper.
I don't know who that is.
And, but they use elements from Delia Darcher's archives.
Yeah, well, the first few are like Doctor Who VIPs, aren't they?
Yeah, but it's really nice record. But inside, I didn't expect this.
There's an LP.
There's two LPs. But one of them, where is it?
Where is it?
It's got a little book. And basically in the film, the guy has had a little book full of drawings. And James that.
Wow.
It's got all the illustrations out of the film.
Cool.
So that's really nice. So, that was worth getting just for that little book in there. And lastly, I've started another podcast called Dark Darzet, Darzet, which explores legends and mysteries and weird goings on in Dorset, which I'm doing with my friend David.
We've done Dorset.
By the time this comes out, there'll be 3 episodes out of that. So we've done the Woodwose of Yellowham Forest. So there's a legend of a Woodwose, which is essentially a British Bigfoot, which is meant to live in the woods near me.
That you, Cleaver?
I was going to say that. Is that not just Ross after a few drinks?
Get up! Get up!
And there's the Singing Barrows of Weymouth, which is apparently some of the barrows. If you go and listen to them at midday, you can hear fairy music. And
what's a barrow? You mean like an earth mound?
A tumulus, yes.
So not like a wheelbarrow.
No. there's a couple of ones near house called the Binkham Bumps. So And the one we're just doing now is the death and the ghost of Lawrence of Arabia, because he died in a motorbike accident near.
Yes. Here. Oh, that's good.
And we've also made videos about all of those, so they're all on YouTube, so check them out. Cool.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
There we are. Very good.
Lots of stuff in that episode. I'm going to, I'll cut that into something which makes sense. But next time, so we had a vote by our listeners of what we're going to watch.
Night of the Demon, wasn't
and
it?
And Night of the Demon won.
Thank God.
By one vote.
Yes.
So we are.
Was that me voting for it?
Probably. So well done, John. You got the one you wanted to watch.
Yes.
So next time will be Night of the Demon, the black and white adaptation of a MIT.
It's coming. It's in the trees.
Yes.
When I was a child, running in the night. Very more of that next time.
Brilliant.
That's the sample from Kate Bush's Hounds of Love.
Excellent. We can use that without paying any royalties, can't we?
She's done all right. She's done all right over the last year, so she won't mind.
She doesn't need our pennies, does she?
But until then.
Yeah, on that bombshell.
Happy day.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening, everyone.
Love, light, and peace, everyone.
Take care.
Yay!
Goodbye.
You have been listening to The General Witchfinders. Support the show and continue the conversation at patreon.com/generalwitchfinders. Subscribe and spread the word. at generalwitchfinders.com. Farewell, and don't have nightmares.
It was okay. There were times in which there was some like ridiculous melodrama happening. Like at one point, the one character goes, "Because I just wanted to prove you wrong for once in your life." Nobody talks like this. No, there was so much sort of theatrical. And as a man who's done a bit of Amdram myself, I did think this is really on the line between Amdram and
amazing.
Britain, James, kind when of you professional. Thought, I thought you was in amateur dramatics. Mm. I just thought of Buzz Lightyear. Was there anything in the play you was in to do with Buzz Lightyear?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, why is my brain...
What play did you do, James?
I did. My colleague and friend from Poole High School, she was a part of an amateur dramatics group. And what they did was that they alternated between doing a musical and a play. But of course, when you do a play, you've got to pay for the rights. So they were two plays that she had written, the play What I Wrote, you know, for all intents and purposes. One was like a play within a play idea. It was all set in a group of people doing amateur dramatics.
Yes.
So there was times in which, like, so we had separated the stage into two. And when we were on the front half of the stage, it was as if we were on the characters were on stage doing their amateur dramatics. And when we were on the rear part, that was like, oh, you know, what's going on?
Is that the one I watched?
I'm not that. Did you watch the murder mystery one? The best bit is my mum. Bless her. My mum is fantastic. She's not. It's where I get it from. She's not the quietest woman you'll ever meet. And she very kindly said that she'd come along with my sisters to watch and support me in this.
Yeah.
And the climax of the first act is that all of the players involved get involved. You know, the issues and the problems come to a head.
Yeah.
And people all storm off stage. They're like, I'm leaving. And then two people start fighting and a bit of the stage falls over and things such as that. And it's just left with me. And I go, okay, if you want to have a chat with the ladies on the front desk, they'll give you your money back, right? And the curtains close. And I just heard my mum go, "Is it finished?
Yeah.
Is that the end?" And I've been so tempted to open. I go, "No, mum, that's half time."
Yeah, I come over and
close. Yeah, you know. So that was her one classic. And then the second one we did, which I got a bit, was really good. She did like an Agatha Christie murder mystery thing, wherein it was all kind of set in the 1920s in sort of like a Dorset country house. And I was the victim. I played like this upstart, rich, you know, American millionaire who'd come over to try and buy his way into like the English gentry. And it was brilliant because I just got to be horrible to everyone for the entire act. Like, hey, you listen to me, doll. You shut your goddamn cake hole. I own this house. And when I say, you do what I say, all right? You know, so I got to do all things like this. It was great. The one night I heard someone gasp. I was so beast. I went, which I thought, oh, wow, you know, this is good. This is going well. But then as I was doing so, it was good in the fact that I died at the end of the first act. So for the second half of the play, I just got to sit my feet up and just come on for the bows at the end. So I was enjoying that. But as is always the way with amateur dramatics, you often run into people who maybe aren't as fully committed to putting on the play as you. And you've got to make the best of whoever turns up and volunteers. So this one old lady, she basically had her lines inside her handbag
at
the times. And she was supposed to be, because it was all supposed to be the 20s, she was from like this temperance guild. And she wanted to come and admonish me for making all my money through alcohol. And then I turned her, I said, "And what are you on, toots?" And she went, and she was supposed to say, "Mr. Prancel, I have been so disgusted with the way that you have made money," and so on and so forth. And I was then going to go, "Oh, yeah, I've heard this all before." And then I went, "And what do you want, toots?" The one night. And she went,
I've forgotten my lines.
And, you know, you just stand there and you think, oh, for fuck's sake. And I looked at her for a moment, like, I just went, no. And I just went, I think, I don't know, but I'm going to guess that maybe you're here because you don't like the fact that I've made money from alcohol. And she went, oh, yes, that is it. I don't like the fact that I just remember thinking, Christ on skates. This is really, and so that was kind of it, really. And the fact that the rehearsal was always on Friday night.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.